Eric, record. There you go.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming. This session is for beginners, people who have no previous experience in Visual Studio, and this is being recorded for a live meeting. So here we are at Code Camp, 2010 April Code Camp. These fine people are sponsoring our meeting today. And this session is for beginners, as I said. I'm going to answer two questions. How do I get started and where do I go from there? Hacks, whether it's a life or a Visual Studio, there's too much to learn for one lifetime. No one person knows it all and things can change overnight and always do. So what do? My suggestion is learn the basics, and that's what we'll be doing this morning. Learn as much as you can to solve the immediate problem and find code examples. Where to get help? The best place to start for general information is msdn.com. This is Microsoft's developer network site. It has tons of information for you. It's a great place to start. And if you click on library, you see the screen that you see in front of you. You can browse through the topics, but another great help is something called walkthroughs. So if you do a search for walkthroughs on msdn.com, you'll find information and directions on how to program applications. So this is an example of one. It says to create a file system website. One, open Visual Studio Developer. So you get the idea, it's like cookbook, you know, step by step by step. Best thing to do is to go through the walkthrough and then move your paper away, your screen, and then try to do it on your own without the directions, see how you do. Now, if we're going to practice, we need to have Visual Studio. If you don't have it, you can get it for free. If you, again, on msdn.com, on the home page, if you look to the left and look for Visual Studio Express, click on that link, click on Downloads, and we can download Visual Basic 2008 Express, Visual C Sharp, and Visual Developer 2008 Express. This is for the web. It's in three pieces. If you have the full version of Visual Studio, it's all in one. But when we download it, it's in three pieces. Along with that, you can also download SQL Server Express so that you can create your own database. So this is really helpful. It's free. It lasts forever. There's no time limit on it, so definitely do that. Sometimes we need help that's very specific. For example, if you get an error message that doesn't make any sense and you want to find out what it means, the best thing to do is take the text or some of the text of that error message, put it into your favorite search engine and see what you find. And most of the time, if not always, you'll find enough information to interpret the message and tell you how to fix whatever the problem is. Printed publications are still great help. Magazines like Code Magazine, Dev Connections, and others, the articles are written by developers. And some of the people who are speaking here today have written articles for these magazines. So a great place to get help. And sometimes you can get a free subscription to it, too. Microsoft, O'Reilly, Acres, Rocks, these are all great places to get books if you want to use books. Now, one of the biggest challenges when you're getting started is that there's no right way or best way to architect a solution. There are many ways. So how do you get started in the right path? A few years ago, some of the big thinkers in computer science realized that all of us solve basically the same problems. So why not identify those problems and then describe a good solution, a good approach to solving those problems? And that's what they've done. And those are called design patterns. There's a group in Microsoft dedicated to this. It's called the Patterns and Practices Group. This book is from that group. So if you need some architect kind of information to help you along, Enterprise Solution Patterns Using Microsoft.net. It's written a few years ago, but because it's not tied specifically to a language, it's great help even today. This is what a pattern looks like. The context, you are building a business solution using layers to organize your application. The problem is, how do you organize your application to reuse business logic, provide deployment flexibility, and conserve valuable resource connections? So the solution is, create three layers, presentation, business logic, and data access, and so on. So they're describing how you would approach this particular problem. Now, the patterns and practices groups have gone one step beyond that. And you can actually download code from them. So if you go to msdn.com and search for design patterns or patterns, you can find the patterns that you can download and actually use the code. So they've gone even one step beyond that. Now another great book, if you're doing web development and you've never done this before, you don't even know what HTML is, this is a great book that I've been using for years. You can read it cover to cover, or you can use it as a resource. It's by Jennifer Needhurst Robbins. It has everything web-related. So it describes HTML and how you write an HTML page. It describes JavaScript and all the other kinds of things, images and all the rest of it. You can create a website using Notepad and a browser. So great book to use if you're doing some web design. Another place to get help is community. User group meetings, code camp like this one, national conferences. Microsoft has quarterly regional seminars that are free. If you go to msdn.com and search for events, then you should be able to find information about that. And they're usually a half-day seminar for developers. It's in the afternoon, so take a look at that. Folks at Microsoft, many of the managers have blogs. Those are fun to read to find out what Microsoft is up to. Okay, Visual Studio. Is there anything I need to know before I get started using either Visual Studio and or SQL Server? And let's start a list of things I need to learn. And here's a good place to start. HTML, XML, object-oriented technology, also known as object-oriented design, object-oriented program, all the OO acronyms. Relational databases and service-oriented architecture. We're not going to talk about the last one, but if you don't know what it is, put it on your list. HTML and XML are not directly related, but they have a common ancestor, and that's SGML, which is standard generalized markup language. So ML means markup language. XML is extensible markup language, and what that means is this is a language to write languages, so you can write your own. And we'll see what that means in a minute. HTML is a language that's already been defined. The World Wide Web Consortium is responsible for keeping the standards for HTML, so we don't have any choice. We have to use the way it is. And this is a comparison of the two. Now, the ML part of it, markup language, means that we use tag. And a tag is a left bracket, a word, and a right angle bracket. So HTML on the left side, XML, those are tags. For HTML, we have a start tag, and we notice at the bottom of that word there's an end tag. It looks exactly the same except that there is a slash in front of it. So these are containers. And embedded within them are other tags. Website has two main tags, head and body. Notice that the title has some verbiage between the start and end tags. So this is what we show in the title bar. The body tag has something even besides just the name in the tag. And this is called an attribute. It's a name value pair. So what that means is the name of the attribute is VG color and the value equals, notice the double quotes, the value is dark red. So we can define attributes for tags. Some tags are used alone. The BR tag is like the carriage return line feed. It's a break. Sometimes it's written BR space slash within it, and we have the break. So it can be written that way. Image tag, we can have a start and end tag for an image. But a shortcut, if we're not going to have anything between those two tags, is to put a slash at the end and then it's used by itself. So we only need one tag. XML On the other hand, it's something we define ourselves. So we start with an XML tag, but under that, I have said that my root tag is customers. So I have a customers start tag, a customers end tag with a slash. Only one root, so we can only have one tag like this. But within it, we have cust tags. So these are our customers. There are three of these nested. They each have an ID attribute. And within the tag, we have two other tags. We can have a name tag. Notice that all three of them have that. And the first one has a vehicle tag, the second one has a hobby tag, and the third one has both of those. So this makes us think that there are rules for this XML document. And in fact, there are. And the rules are we can have the root tag is customers. We can have a cost tag. We can have one or more of them in our file. We must have one name tag for each of the cust tags. And then we can have a vehicle element, zero or more, and we can have a hobby element, zero or more, or it could be zero or one. Those kinds of rules are called the schema. And if we know what the schema is for an XML document, we can tell if it's been written correctly, if it's valid. Now, if you look at that file, we get the impression that this is kind of like a database. It looks like database data, certainly. This is like a self-describing database. And the great thing is that we can send this across the internet. We don't care about what's at the other end because we don't, most of the time, don't know what's at the other end. But they can understand our data because we're using standard XML. So this is a self-describing database or can be. Okay, next topic, object-oriented programming. What does that mean? Everything in the world is an object, whether it's a tree, whether it's a desk, or whatever. As human beings, we like to classify things to make some sense or some organization out of our world. So a class is like a blueprint for an object or a group of objects. It can also be like a type definition. Classes have members. These are public members. It means if we're using the class, these are things that are exposed, that's the word that's used, to us. Can have public properties, which is the data associated with that object. It can have public methods, which is behaviors or functions that that object can carry out. And it can have events, which are a change of state of that object that we can react to. We can write code to react to that. So let's look at the example. This is a bank account class. And it has four properties, account ID, account type, customer ID, balance. In addition, it has four behaviors, accept deposit, withdraw funds. Now look at the next two, report balance. It's the same name. So how can we have two functions with exactly the same name? Well, the difference is the number and type of parameters. So if I call the method report balance, and all I give it is an account ID, then I'll get my current balance. If I call report balance, and I provide it the account ID and the balance date, it will give me the balance on that date. So the difference is that we have the same name, but the parameters decide which one is going to, which implementation we're going to use. If we create objects from our class, these are called instances of the class. It's like bringing the class to life. An object exists in time and space. And in this case, if we're talking about programming, it means that we've allocated space in memory or on a hard drive somewhere. So now we have something that actually exists. This is called instantiation. We get the impression from looking at our class that it's pretty much self-contained. We get the idea that there's kind of a border or a boundary around it, and within that is the implementation of that class. But we have these public members that give us some way of interacting with it. It's kind of like a house with windows and no doors. You can pass data in and out. You can pass requests in and out for the methods. You can react to the events, but you can't get inside to see how it's implemented. And that's because these are pre-compiled. You'll find them in a .dll file. So when we set a reference to a DLL file. That's what we're doing. We're going out to get that class definition. Polymorphism is this whole, the report balance where we have two functions or methods with the same name but different parameters. So there's a different implementation behind it, but we're using the same name. And then inheritance, let's say that our bank decides that we don't really want to create objects from our bank account class. That's kind of abstract. We're going to create two subclasses. We'll have a checking account class and a savings account class, and those two classes will inherit all of the behaviors and data from the bank account class. So that's inheritance. The same thing, it has all of the members of the superclass, but then more besides, depending on which class it is. Relational databases. Anybody not familiar with a relational database? Okay, so we can go through this pretty quickly. As you know, relational databases comprise of tables and the relationships between the tables. If we want to find out who ordered a box of pencils, we start with the order items table. We follow the foreign key order ID up to the orders table where it's the primary key. And then we follow the foreign key customer ID to the customers table to get where the primary key is. And that's where we find the name, first name and last name of that customer. So it means that the data is normalized. We only keep it in one place. And if you've never seen the SQL Server Management Studio, this is what it looks like. This is Express. On the left side, we have all the tables and other objects in our database. We have here a query, which might be a stored procedure. And then underneath the data, which looks a little bit like our spreadsheet. Okay, so those are all the basics. If there's anything you don't know there, make sure you put that on your list. There are two things that are happening behind the scenes in Visual Studio that we need to know something about. First is the common language runtime. We can write the same application in C#, Visual Basic, and other languages. And that application is not compiled. We use the word build. We build into intermediate language, which looks a little like assembler. Both C# and Visual Basic will build to the same intermediate language, and then that will be interpreted or compiled down to machine language. So it doesn't matter which language we use, we get to the same place. The framework. Imagine if you had to write every single line of code in order to run your application. Well, of course, we're not doing that. We haven't done that from the very beginning. Microsoft provides us with literally thousands of classes. They are organized into the framework, and you'll hear people talk about framework 2.0, framework 3.5, framework 4.0. These are versions, and each version builds on the one before. These classes are provided by Microsoft, and you'll see what that looks like in a minute. We're going to be looking at the development environment. We talked about the IDE, Integrated Development Environment. We can create all kinds of applications, and these are just some of them. ADO.NET is a traditional way of getting data into an application. The newer way is Link, and later presentations today will talk about Link. Okay, so let's go to our demo. So the first thing we're going to do is develop a website. The first time you start this up, if you have the full version, it's going to ask you what your favorite language is. So you may see that. All right. As you can see, we have a series of windows that makes up our development environment. This is going to be a little tough because you can see all of it. Okay, so let's look at the Solution Explorer window first. Now, the one in the middle is the start page. You can turn that off. Mine comes up every time because I wanted to, but it doesn't happen. So we're going to start a new website. One way to do it is from the start page, click on website, or we can click on file, new website. These are templates, so we'll let it know what kind of an application we want to write. In this case, we've chosen the website. I'm going to create it in the file system. This is my path, and I'm going to use Visual C Sharp. I could have used Visual Basic just as easily. Click OK. We can specify if we want a particular name for our website. Obviously, we can call it Website Sharp. So this is what our template has created for us. Now, this app underscore data folder has a very specific purpose. It's a place where we can store the data for our website. There are other folders like that. If you do a search in msdn.com for app underscore data, one of the articles that it will bring up is ASP.NET website layout, and that will describe this folder and others that can be used, standard folders that are used for websites. So take a look at that. Default.asps is the name of our web page. Now the reason, if you haven't done any web development, the reason that is given that name is because the web server knows that if the browser is not requesting a particular page, that's the page that it will display. Chances are you don't want to use that name for your home page. So if you want to call it home.aspx, you have to go to the web server and specify that file name so it knows to use that file name as your website. And web config we'll talk about in a moment. Alright, so Solution Explorer, now we have something in it. And these are basically the files that are in this application. If I click on the plus sign to expand this, we also have another file, but because we have Nest-related files turned on, we have to expand to see it. Now, if I click this again and turn it off, this would be what it would look like in Windows Explorer. So we get the impression now that these two files are related, and we'll see how they are in a minute. Underneath, we have the Properties window. Whatever is highlighted, that's the properties that you will see in that window. Okay. Properties should ring a bell. Properties is related to objects, related to classes, and that's exactly what's going on here. This is the design surface that we'll be working on. Underneath that, we have an error list or output. So if we're getting messages, it'll be an output. If we want to see what our errors are, we can click on error list. So we have tabs underneath some of these windows to help us find other windows because it's just not enough room for all of them. On the left side, this is the toolbox. These are all of the classes or controls that would be on our website that we can use for our website. If we shrink that, you can see that there are many, many of them. So they're organized into groups to make it a little easier to find them. Now, these other two tabs are for working with styles and style sheets. We're not going to do that today, so we're just ignore that. A web page is like a Word document. You can't navigate around the web page unless there's something there. If you're working in Word, if you want to put something in the middle of your page, you have to hit the Enter key to get down to where you want to put it. You can't just move a mouse over it and put it someplace. Same kind of thing here. This is called flow layout. But when we have web pages, we want some very specific positioning of our controls on the web page. So how do we do that? Traditionally, we've used the table, although that may not have been its original purpose, that's what it's being used for now. So this is a 3x3 table. It's an HTML table, an HTML control. And I can type in one of those cells. Today is Saturday. Or if I close down the HTML list and look at the standard list, I can put a label in the middle cell. I can put a button on the left, on the right, rather. I can put a text box. So all I'm doing is dragging and dropping what I want on my website. This is instantiation. The classes are the list under the word standard. When I drag it to the design surface, now it becomes an object. An object has data associated with it. Okay, so this is instantiation. So our text box is highlighted, and down in the properties window we see all of the or many of the properties for a text box. The label. I don't want to have it just say label. I want to have it be the name, the title of my web page. So if I look for the text property, I can change the label here to my web page. And if I click away from that, you see that it changes it in the design window. Button, I think I'll change the name of that one, the text button face. Okay, so now, notice we're in design mode. We can also go to source mode, because we know that websites are composed of HTML code. Well, I don't see any HTML code here. Where is it? If you click on source, then you can see the HTML. And notice that whatever was highlighted in the design view is also highlighted in the source view. So if we scroll up to the top, it looks like standard HTML that you could write with Notepad until we get here. ASP:label. That's not standard HTML. That's called a server control or an ASP server control. And what it means is that the server has to, our web server has to interpret this into what HTML would be, would carry out the same properties. So this label has an ID called label 1. It says run at server. So we are depending on the server to do some processing for us with this tag or this control, and the text is the text that I typed before, my web page. Right? Now let's say we want to run this page. There's some things that we have to do. First of all, we want to save it. If you look up in the tab at the bottom of the top of the design surface, notice that there's an asterisk. That means that we've made changes and they have not been saved. So to save them, we can click on save just this file, or we can save all of the files that we've been working with. Either one works, and the asterisk goes away. Now the reason we can just click on that is because we gave it the path when we created the website to begin with, so it knows where to save it. The next thing we have to do is to build the application, build the website. So we can go to build, and you can say build a page, build a website, or say build a website. And if you look in the status bar at the bottom, now this is quick because it's so small, but if it were a bigger application, you would see it giving messages that it's building the application and finally it's been successful. If we want to run the web page, to render it in a browser, we click on debug. This is one way to do it. We can start debugging or start without debugging. If we're thinking about walking through the code, then we probably want to start to debug. If I click on that, a pop-up comes up that says the page cannot be run in debug mode because debugging is not enabled in the web config. All right, what does that mean? The web config file is a file of settings. Sometimes there might even be data in it. This file is separate from the application in that when we build the application, which is similar to compiling, it doesn't touch this file. So if you have a test environment and a production environment and you want to run the same application in both without having to rebuild it, you can do that. But because it doesn't touch the web config file, you can have different settings in test and production. One of those settings could be the connection string to your database so that it will use the test database in the test environment or the production database in the production environment. It was saying that there's something in this file that doesn't allow us to debug, and turns out we have a compilation tab. Notice this is XML, and it says debug false. Now I could type true here and it would change it. But let's go back to trying to run our website again. This green arrow is the same as from the debug menu dropdown. So I'll click on that and it says, do we want to let the application create it? And we say, okay. And if we looked at it, we could see that now it would be true. So now it's rendering our website. everything that I typed is there. I click on a click here and it doesn't do anything. Well, that's because we didn't tell it to do anything. So now we have to do some programming. So I'm going to close the web page down. Let's go back to the web page. We don't see any code here. We don't see any HTML. We don't see any code either. So where is it? One way to get to it is to right click and say view code. But instead of doing that, I'm going to double click on the control that I want to write code for. And what this does is it put a stub in here for a function. Take a look at the way it's named. Button 1 is the name of the control that we're writing the code for. And underscore click is the click event. Every control, just about every control, has a default event. And in this case, the click event is the most obvious event for a button. There are other events too, but this is the one that's usually used. Now, what that means is this is an event handler. So when the user clicks on that button, there's a change of state for that control. And now we can write code as a response to that change of state. So I'm going to set the text box and notice as this pop-up comes up, it has a list of all of the classes and objects which are in scope. So if I look, now here's text box. What is that? We have text box and we have text box one. Text box is the class. So if we wanted to do something with the class, instantiate the class in code, that's we would use that one. Text box 1 is the text box that's on our web page. That's the one we want. I can double click on it or I can hit the tab key and it will accept it. Now we have this red squiggly. What does that mean? If we mouse over it, it says error. And it gives a long description of what the error is. In addition to that, we can find the same error down here in our error list. There are two errors, as a matter of fact. The first one says that there's no semicolon at the end of the statement. Well, we didn't finish writing it, so of course it's not there yet. But what's this other one? It says only assignment, call, increment, decrement, and so on. Means that we haven't finished writing what we need for this text box. The idea is we want to put text in the text box when we click on the button. Well, we can't just put text in the text box. It has to go through our property. We use dot notation. So hit dot, and then now we have another pop-up. And these are all the properties and the methods and the events that are associated with that text box control. If I start typing, I can find text. If I highlight it, I hit the tab key. Well, the squiggly is still there, so it means I'm not done yet. Put an equal sign. Okay, if we look down at our errors now, you see that that second error went away. We fixed it. If we double click on an error in the error list, it'll take us to where the error is. So if you have a very long file and you have some errors, this will jump to wherever the errors are. I'm going to leave that error for a moment, and I'm going to try to run the website and let's see what happens. If there's an error in our code, it tells us that. We can't go any further. It says, would you like to continue and run the last successful build? Well, I don't want to do that. I want to fix the error. So I say no. Go to my error, double click, brings me to where the error is. I know I have to put a semicolon there. Sometimes it'll refresh right away, sometimes it won't. So let's try running it now. And if we click on click here, that's the word show up. If you click in the browser, if you click on view source, we can see what the HTML looks like. Okay. Standard HTML, view state, it's a hidden field. We don't do anything with that. What it's used for, because the internet is stateless, the server sends you a web page and forgets who you are. We have to have some way to pass data back and forth for continuity, and that's what the hidden element, the input element view state is 4. It saves that data and passes it back and forth. There's another one here too. Here we have our tables. Looks pretty much the same as they did, but wow, what happened to our ASP colon label? That's not there anymore. The server has transformed it into standard HTML, which is a span, and it has my website as the text, which is what we wrote. Look what happened to the text box. That's an input element. This button is an input element, but it's a submit type. So it has transformed our design elements into standard HTML. Let's walk through some code. I'm going to add another statement here just to make it a little more interesting. We'll say label text migrate web page. I'm going to change that label when the application runs. Well, you know, that's kind of presumptuous. Maybe I don't want to do that. So I can comment it out. If it's just one line, slash, slash, we'll comment the line. But there's an easier way. We go up to the top of our screen. There is a button that says comment out selected lines or uncomment selected lines. If I click on that button, it will comment that line. Okay, if you have a big block of code that you want to comment out, this absolutely saves you time. And if you want to uncomment it, then we take the on the line, we uncomment. All right, so there's a toggle back and forth. If we want to walk through code, debug. There is a gray bar on the left side. We click the page is running, that's what I think of. If we click in the gray bar, it puts a red circle, a red ball in that bar. That's a breakpoint. If you use other debuggers, you know, a breakpoint will stop the execution at that point. So I'll run my website. Okay, I clicked on the button. So now it will take me. Notice it's highlighted in yellow. That's the next statement to be executed. It has not been executed yet. Because I'm in break mode, I can click on this, which is represents the web page. And if I look down at our text box, you can see the properties. And the text property is still empty. F11 executes that line and steps to the next statement. So you can go one beyond that, and now it says, hello world. So these are, locals are objects and variables that are within scope. You can use watch, and you can define your own if you want to. Okay? To continue and finish, you just click on the button, and it finishes up. Now. Close my page down. The page looks kind of lackluster, but we want to make it look a little nicer, so how do we do that? If we select the text that we had in the properties, notice this is just a cell, so it's a CD. There's no text property here, but there is a style property. And I can change font. Font size, large, weight, bold, and the style to italic. These are all of the settings that I just set. Say okay. And now those settings are actually in the style property. Okay. Okay, so that's the basics of creating a website. Let's close that down. Now let's start a Windows application. And I'll create a new project. This is a Windows Form application. We would want to name it appropriately. And now we have our form. And notice that the design environment is pretty much the same, even though our application is different. And we could do the same thing that we did before. We can put a button. We can put a label. Xbox. See the blue line that's there? That helps us to position things. Notice I didn't have to use a table like I did in the website. That's because this is closer to PowerPoint. Now with PowerPoint, you can put things wherever you want. That's the same thing here. So if it's a Windows application, you don't have to have a table for positioning. So I'd like to get some data into my application, so I'm going to scroll down. And go and bring in a data grid view. This is called a smart tag. The other pop-ups we saw were IntelliSense. They guided us to some of the things available to us. This helps us set up this control because there's a little more that's needed than just the text box. So it's asking me, what's my data source? If this is going to be a list of data, we need to have a data source. Well, there's none listed, so I'll go to add project data source. It's going to be a database. I say next. And it knows that I have a database already. If I click on connection string, that's the path to that database. And the application needs three things to work with a database. It needs to know where the data is, it needs to know what data we want, and it needs to know where to put it. So this is answering that first question, where's the database? Now the next thing we need to know is what data do we want to bring back from our database? And say, yes, that's our connection string. Now it's going out to the database that's local on this machine, and it's going to find all the objects in it so we can decide which ones we want to use. What we're going to use is something called a data set. A data set is like a little database inside your application. It has tables like a database has tables. It has relationships like the database has relationships. All right, here's my list of tables. I'm going to take the data from the aircraft table, and that's what I'm going to use. And notice it's giving us a data set name. Now, you can change this name, of course. So I say finish. Okay, I can preview the data here. I'm not going to. Notice what it's created for us. This is not on the screen. This is not something anyone sees. This is behind the scenes. So I have my flight school data set. I can edit it in a designer. So it looks just like a database table. If I right click, I can preview the data. And this is the data that's in that table. This is the data we expect to see in our control when we run that application. We have a binding source. Somehow we have to get the data from the data set that we've captured using the table adapter. The table adapter brings it into the data set, and now we have to get it into our control. That's what the binding source does. That's the conduit from one to the other. So let's run our application. And we can scroll and see that we have the data from that table. Now, you may not want to do it that way because it doesn't give you a lot of control. You may want to do all of these things in code, and that can be done. So if you want to find out more information on how to do that, ABO.net, search on that, and MSDN.com, and you will see how that is done. That's the end of my presentation. I hope that helps you to get started. Mark, how do I... Yeah. offline because we're running over.